Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Thursday morning, May 7th. Currently 44 degrees here in Old Town Park City with some clouds. Heber City reporting 46 degrees. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Thursday. Let's look at your forecast today. We're going to have a few extra clouds moving across the Wasatch back as we go into your Thursday. So instead of sunny skies, look for partly cloudy to partly sunny skies out there for us. This afternoon, we'll see these temperatures warming up, though significantly warmer than our Wednesday. We're going to be looking at high temperatures for your Thursday afternoon in the mid-60s in Park City. We're talking high temperatures jumping into the low 70s for us in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Friday, hey, that warm-up continues, a little more sunshine. Temperatures warming up to the upper 60s in Park City, and we'll see those high temperatures climbing into the mid-70s for us over towards the Heber Valley. Moving into the upcoming weekend, your Mother's Day weekend looks fantastic out there with lots of sunshine, but you will notice that warming trend continuing, so high temperatures back in the upper 60s on your Saturday in Park City. We'll be in the mid-70s again for us in the Heber Valley by the time we move towards your Mother's Day on Sunday. Oh my, lots of sunshine, highs climbing into the mid-70s in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures jumping into the low 80s in the Heber Valley. Absolutely gorgeous weather for your Mother's Day weekend. Heading in early next week, a big ridge of high pressure begins to move our way. This is a summer-like ridge of high pressure that's going to build in. So you know what that means. Absolutely dry conditions expected for the next several days. But more importantly, that dry air compresses and heats up quickly. So we're going to be talking about a significant warming trend heading into early next week. How warm? Well, let's talk about it for your Monday. Look for lots of sunshine in Park City. That sunshine will continue for your Tuesday and Wednesday. Same story in the Heber Valley. Sunshine on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Now let's talk about those temperatures. Morning lows only dipping down into the 40s with daytime highs in Park City in the low 80s for your Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of next week. High temperatures in the Heber Valley, upper 80s to near 90 degrees. Summer heat on the way. That's your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Councilmember Tanya Hansen, recapping yesterday's meeting. From the Wasatch Immigration Project, Executive Director Maggie Abu-Haidar with the latest on immigration issues and how the Women's Giving Fund grant money is being spent. And from the Summit County Library, Library Director Dan Compton with details about this year's One Book, One Community Read. Then stay tuned for Cool Science Radio. Today's guest include data journalist and author Simon Rogers, whose new book, What We Ask Google, dives into 20 years of Google searches to uncover what we're really curious about. All of that coming up on Cool Science Radio, of course, heard every Thursday from 9 to 10. After a winter of open houses, Heber City leaders are narrowing down what the city's Main Street Park will look like. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports survey results show residents prefer green space over retail shops.
Heber City is redesigning its downtown park in hopes of making it a year-round destination for locals and visitors alike. The city hired consultants to dive into locals' preferences with open houses and a survey. The council took a close look at feedback from about 400 people at its May 5th meeting. Architect Ryan Wallace said about 45% of the people surveyed thought the designs were on the right track, and 36% did not like the concepts. The other 19% were somewhere in the middle.
For some of the yeses, they said things like, as a high schooler, I'd love to see a place like this where we could hang out. On the no scale, we heard very strongly, I don't care about downtown being a destination for anyone else. I want this to be for Heber residents first.
Overall, the consultants said residents want a focus on green space and trees, unstructured gathering spaces like picnic pavilions and playgrounds, and upgrades to essentials like public restrooms. They shared a preferred master plan with a larger lawn, an accessible playground, and a smaller paved plaza. Councilmember Sid Ostergaard said it will take some time to review all the survey results and recommendations.
Thank you for listening to us and doing this public outreach. This is very important that we're to this stage on this project. So I'm excited for the next steps. And I agree, give us at least 2 weeks to look and study, and because there's a lot.
Councilmember Yvonne Barney encouraged locals to reach out to city leaders with feedback. A few residents shared their opinions of the plans Tuesday night, mostly negative. Allison Salisbury said she's worried about parking. She thinks most locals want the park to stay more or less the same. Alexandra Fulmer suggested the city rely on development in the North Village to provide community programming.
With the slopes to the north, you know, they're building their own entire commerce area, restaurant area, social hangout area. That's going to be a significant amount of competition that we just don't have budget for. So maybe let them do all the work.
Others said they think an ice ribbon is a bad idea because they don't want to compete with Midway's skating rink. The City Council will discuss the plans again at its meeting May 19th. To learn more about the survey results, visit kpcw.org. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, the rehabilitation of the Silver King Coalition Mine Headframe Building is being honored this week by a state preservation organization, and the community is invited to celebrate. For seven decades, the remains of one of Park City's most iconic and productive silver mines sat vacant, and its windows often used as target practice. After 5 years of work and more than $1.6 million in investment, the Silver King mine shaft has now been permanently closed and the headframe building stabilized. Later this year, it will be featured as part of the new 7 Mile Historic Mine hiking tour. According to the Park City Museum, the Silver King Coalition shaft house, located at the base of the Bonanza chairlift, closed in 1953 when metal prices dropped below profitable levels. The structure houses the original shaft, headframe, and hoisting system. Over time, it deteriorated and was nearly lost, in part because it stood above an open mine shaft. Project manager Byron Buck says decades of neglect, combined with damage from the installation of the Bonanza chairlift in the 1990s and then heavy snowfall during the 2022-23 winter season, caused the shaft to begin collapsing, prompting urgent action.
So we needed to get that shaft stabilized so it wouldn't collapse any further. Luckily, we were able to team with the state of Utah Division of Oil, Gas, and Mining, and they were tremendous to help us get that shaft stabilized and closed permanently. Then that allowed us to go and preserve the rest of the building, because it would have been unwise to spend our donors' money to try to repair the building itself if there was a potential for the shaft to collapse and take the whole thing with it.
The shaft was sealed with an environmentally approved polyurethane foam.
We hired an engineering firm that specializes in this kind of mine closure, and I learned that they pour this stuff in as a liquid, and it expands into this really strong foam that attaches to the sides of the shaft and becomes like a cork, and it seals the shaft. And then on top of that, they put in crushed rock, and then there's an 18-inch thick concrete slab on top of all of that. We did have the foam analyzed, potential environmental contaminants, and it passed with flying colors.
While the state funded the shaft closure, friends of Ski Mountain Mining History paid for the building restoration. Co-founder Sally Elliott says the site represents an important piece of Park City's past.
The Silver King was probably the most financially successful mine, and it gave us some of our greatest characters. Tom Kearns and David Keith and John Judge and Jim Ivers. It really provided us with wonderful human interest stories that we love to tell our hikers and bikers and history lovers.
The Friends Group will be honored with the Cindy Matsumoto Historical Preservation Award at today's City Council meeting. On Friday, Park City Municipal will host an historic preservation celebration at the McPullen Barn from 4 to 6 p.m., inviting residents to connect with those working to protect the city's heritage. The event will include music from DJ Silver King, food and drinks, and short tours of the barn. Attendees are encouraged to bring any historical materials to share. A video memory station will allow visitors to record stories about their favorite historic sites or a local story. Guests are encouraged to walk, bike, or take public transit. Free parking and a shuttle to the farm will be available from the North Marsac parking lot at City Hall, as well as the Munchkin Road parking lot from 3:30 to 7 p.m. A bike valet will also be available on site. Organizers ask attendees to RSVP in advance to help plan for food and beverages. That link is online at kpcw.org. The Summit County Council met yesterday, and on the phone with a recap of the meeting, I have Councilmember Tanya Hansen. Good morning, Tanya.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's see. The state of Utah provides a fund to help local governments cover the cost of aggravated murder cases. Deputy County Manager Jana Young yesterday said that the county wasn't aware of this fund, apparently, when the Corey Richens case broke 3 years ago. So tell us, the county can now tap the state's fund?
So, yes, there is the Utah's Indigent Aggravated Murder Defense Fund, short title. And this is to support counties in managing cases involving aggravated murder, which are often complex, expensive, and require specialized legal resources. So we are applying to tap into this defense fund to help cover costs of what we believe will be an appeal by the Corey Richens defense team.
So too late to pay for the trial, prosecution, and investigation that's already happened?
Correct. And my understanding is this defense fund is basically for appeals.
Oh, okay. Any idea, do we have a final cost on the trial at this point?
Well, at this point, we figure we have paid, it has cost Summit County taxpayers well over $1 million on this particular case.
Okay.
And that does not include ongoing costs of an appeal, which we're anticipating will happen.
Okay. So tell us how this works. The city pays in a couple $100,000 and then has to pay annually?
So the estimated cost to join is $153,247 for Summit County, and this is based on tax revenues. It's a percentage of tax revenues is how they calculate that. And then moving forward, the estimated contribution will be $80,000. So total for us to get into this fund is just a little over $200,000.
Okay. And we've got money in the budget to cover that.
Yes, because the for 2026, the county attorney's budget is operating under budget right now, so they have the variance to cover that.
Hmm. And at this point, an appeal, I don't believe, has been filed. I mean, because she's yet to be sentenced.
Correct. The sentencing date, I think, is May 13th. And so we are anticipating there will absolutely be at least one appeal, if not more than one, through the years, frankly. This could go on for quite some time.
Mm. Any idea how expensive the appeals process could be and how long it could take, at least for the first one?
No idea. We didn't discuss that. We just know it will be very costly.
Okay. So it sounds like Utah County had asked for money and got $1 million from the state to prosecute Tyler Robinson, who is charged with shooting Charlie Kirk. So how did they, or they haven't gotten that? We don't know that yet. I mean, I guess, would you like to see Summit County ask for its cost to be reimbursed for the Corey Richens case?
Absolutely. We would like to see that ask. We don't know if that will happen. The Charlie Kirk case is such a very high-profile case that the legislature decided to appropriate $1 million to Utah County to help cover that that expense. I don't know if that was a one-time fee, if counties can apply. I'm not really sure about the details behind that.
All right. The council also held a joint discussion with the Eastside Planning Commission about the long-term development on that side of the county. I guess, what prompted this joint meeting?
Well, this used to happen on a regular basis, that every once in a while the county council would meet with both planning commissions, Snyderville and Eastern Summit County, just, you know, to check the temperature and answer any questions and provide feedback of what we think our opinions are on certain things. So it was just a conversation. And it's just good communication, and we look forward to having more of these into the future.
Oh, so you will plan to schedule more regular joint meetings?
Yes. Yes, we will.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the fact that Eastside Planning Commissioner David Darcy kind of started the discussion by asking about the village overlay zone. It's supposed to be a tool to concentrate housing density and protect open agriculture space. You had thoughts about the zone. What do you think about it?
Yeah, first of all, let me start by saying it was a great meeting that we had with the Planning Commission last night. And David Darcy asked, you know, what is your interpretation of a village? And I kind of went off on the village overlay zone, which the intention of the village overlay zone was to work with property owners from the ground up to develop areas where there could possibly be a village, where maybe historically there was a village, and help recreate that. The problem that happened in this instance in Hoytsville is that grassroots effort, the property was sold to a huge developer, and that changed the intent of the village overlay zone. My problem with the village overlay zone is it doesn't have any guardrails on it. It doesn't talk about affordable housing, density, commercial space. So all of that conversation with that developer, it didn't go anywhere, frankly, because there was no guardrails to help move those conversations along.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the Cedar Crest property?
The Cedar Crest development in Hoytsville, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, so it sounds like this village overlay zone will be revised?
We didn't specifically talk about that, but that would be what I would like to see happen.
Mm-hmm. The Planning Commission chair also talked about various efforts to create whole towns. I mean, is this zone inviting larger scale development than what we're looking for in a rural area?
That's my interpretation, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What was your reaction to the news about Ivory Homes' plans for Browns Canyon?
Well, that's an interesting application. They're asking for a rezone. They're not asking for a village overlay, is my understanding. You know, there's a lot of baggage around that application, a lot of high density. It's in front of the Planning Commission right now. I haven't read the application or anything like that, so I don't know all of the details, but it's an interesting application.
All right, and we should note that the Eastern Summit County Planning Commission will be discussing that Ivory Homes plans starting 6 o'clock at the Camas Library at the Planning Commission level. When you kind of look out over the east side right now, I mean, do you like the direction it's headed development-wise?
Well, I call the Colville area where I live the last frontier because, you know, development is slowly, now quickly moving this way. I mean, I think development is inevitable. It just needs to be controlled and, as I stated, have guardrails on it. As long as the development happens with public, amenities that help the community as a whole, I think there is good things happening. But these huge, high-density developments is really changing our quality of life on the east side.
Okay. Moving on, the Utah legislature moved up the deadline to apply for the property tax discount that all primary property owners get. The date was November 30th. It was moved up to September 15th. The council, though, voted to move it back to November 30th. How come?
We can't move it back. We can't change what the state legislature has endorsed. So the state now requires all primary residential exemption applications to be submitted by September 15th. This is going to be challenging for all our departments that process these because we have so many. The number I have heard is over 50% of the residents in Summit County as second homeowners. And out of those, how many apply for primary residential is a very large number. So this change for Summit County for September 15th instead of November 30th is very difficult for our departments to manage. So last night, what these departments asked us is if we could implement a program where folks need to apply for primary residential exemption by September 15th. That is the code, that's the law now. However, we want to put in some flexibility there that if people apply between September 16th and November 30th, they can do that, but there will be a fee of $150. And then these applications during this period will be handled as an abatement to your tax bill or a reduction. And it will not change the value of your property until probably the following year. So that's how that process is going to happen moving forward.
Okay. And you said it's going to be an ugly year. And I'm guessing, what did you mean? That we're going to see people not listening to this interview right now and then be surprised come September 16th?
That's exactly what I meant by that. That, you know, a lot of people just don't pay attention. They don't pay attention to their tax bill. And then at the last minute, they go, oh, no, this, you know, I really have a primary house and it's showing, is it secondary? And I need to get this tax figured out and it's too late. So that's what I meant. It's going to be very cumbersome for departments.
Well, and as we've seen, years go by before people even catch the fact that they have been paying taxes on a primary home. Is there some way to alert people to this? I mean, do you just send out notices to?
Well, it's right on the tax bill. It will state on the tax bill. I think that our elected officials have done a really good job on that tax bill to try to alert people that this is a secondary home. You know, how it is listed, and people just don't pay attention to those things, unfortunately.
All right. Well, again, residents should know that anytime they change the title on their home, they become, for tax purposes, a second homeowner, and that means almost twice the taxes. So it means having to contact the county assessor if that happens?
That's correct, and they fill out a form and take care of it that way. Yes, and it is on the property owner to take care of this. It is an automatic. If you don't apply for this change, that you are a primary resident, it automatically goes to a second home resident. So, and it's a 45% tax increase. So it's really important for people to pay attention to that and look at your tax bill to make sure that it is a primary residence on that tax bill.
All right. Finally, just wanted to ask you about your reaction to the recent ICE detentions in Summit County.
It's heartbreaking, really. That's my reaction. It's really sad. I'm sorry to see that happening in our community. I wish there were more that we could do to help these folks, but it's really out of our hands. It's a sad situation.
Yeah. And what about the possibility that these license plate readers that local taxpayers have paid for are getting used to find and detain people? I mean, should we take a look at that?
I don't know if that's in our purview or not, frankly. I would need to have a conversation with the county attorney and the sheriff about that. But it's very sad times that we're living in right now.
Okay, so it's not our choice to decide where cameras go and whether or not they stay up.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that to comment.
Who is in charge? We don't know.
I would assume somehow the sheriff's office is involved in that, but I really don't know.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Tanya?
No, thank you very much. Enjoy this beautiful day.
Thank you. That's Summit County Council Member Tanya Hansen. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. These past few weeks have been filled with news about the ICE sweep in Park City and Summit County. And in the studio, tell us about the immigration issues that the Wasatch Back is seeing. I have the co-founder of the Wasatch Immigration Project, Maggie Abu Haidar. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so maybe just first start by explaining what the Wasatch Immigration Project is and how it serves immigrants here in the Wasatch Back.
So Wasatch Immigration Project is a nonprofit organization based here in Park City. We provide pro bono or no-cost immigration legal advice, representation, and education to community members who are navigating the immigration process. In providing those services, we do prioritize individuals and families who live or work in the Wasatch Back.
All right. So what gaps in services did you see that kind of led to the creation of the project?
So we were founded in late 2023. We opened our office in June of 2024. So we've been in practice for about 2 years. At the time when we opened the practice, all four of the co-founding volunteer attorneys had been volunteering down in the valley with another immigration law nonprofit. And we realized that we all lived in Park City and we were traveling down the highway to help solve a problem in the valley when there were no services available in the Wasatch Back for those who were navigating the immigration process. We were in effect an immigration law desert up here in terms of pro bono services.
Mm-hmm. And the project is funded how?
So the project is funded, we are a nonprofit, like any nonprofit, even though we are a law firm. We are funded by private donations by individuals and foundations, as well as grants. And so we also have a tremendous volunteer force. Last year, we had about 11 volunteers who contributed over 4,000 hours of time, including 7 attorneys.
Wow, doing what?
We take cases. I am, in addition to being a volunteer executive director, I am also a volunteer attorney for the project. Two of my other co-founders are also not exactly full-time, but pretty darn close to being full-time volunteer attorneys. And so we take cases, we represent clients, but we also are, at least two of us are heavily invested in sort of the organizational health of the organization as well. I do executive director functions, and then John Sharkey, one of our other co-founders, is our volunteer controller. And so together we've really filled a lot of gaps that will ultimately be filled by paid staff, you know, as we grow and become more of a mature organization.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the most pressing immigration-related challenges facing folks here in the Wasatch Back.
Yes, of course. Hands down, I think the most pressing issue right now is the threat of ICE detention, as you mentioned in your opening. Detentions in Utah increased threefold in 2025, and with the threat of a 10,000-bed ICE detention facility coming on board in Salt Lake City, we anticipate that number only to grow in 2026. And as you mentioned, in just the past 2 weeks, we've seen two significant ICE operations in the Wasatch Back, in Heber City on April 21st, and then in Park City on April 28th. And, you know, the Park City sweep resulted in the highly publicized case of Lisandro being detained. He was a Park City high school graduate who was stopped by ICE on his way to work. He came to the U.S. when he was just 1 year old. When he was stopped, he did have a valid driver's privilege card, insurance, and no criminal history. So there is no real valid reason for the stop or the detention as far as we understand. He was detained and sent to Wyoming and ultimately is now being held in California. This was and is extraordinarily sad for the Park City community. He was a Bright Futures kid, Park City High School grad, known to a lot of folks here in the community. And Lisandro's attorney is working hard to not only get him released, but to adjust his status so that he can stay in the U.S. Notably, Park City showed up really strong for this kid. We were at the press conference at his attorney's office last Thursday, and I would say, close to 100 people showed up from Park City.
Yeah. I just want to talk a little bit about that, because we've got the people who support the federal efforts to, you know, take care of people who are not here legally. In fact, we heard from, I think it was the Homeland Security Director, we haven't seen anything yet, something to that effect. So, you know, somebody, you know, in this kid's case, he had no choice about coming here. What are his options? I mean, he really has nothing to go back to because he knows nothing about where he came from.
I think that's right. You know, Lisandro actually falls within the class of kids who would qualify for DACA. Unfortunately, DACA has been paused due to litigation. But everything you just mentioned is the reason for DACA, which is we have kids who came to our country. They could make no choice to whether to come or not come. At 1 year old, you cannot commit a crime by being in a country illegally. They've made every effort to be here since they became of age of majority, turned 18, to apply for DACA status and maintain DACA status. And yet, you know, we're stuck in a place, and I think you and I had talked about this before, but, you know, national immigration policy is set at a national level. It impacts all individuals navigating the immigration system, whether they live here in Utah or Maine or Louisiana or California. But it is set largely by the executive branch, the president and his agencies. It is enforced by federal agents, also part of the executive branch. Congress can pass laws governing immigration, but the last immigration law of any significance was passed in 1996. So Congress has really been sitting on this one for about 30 years. One of the notable times when they almost reached consensus and were able to pass something was around the issue of DACA. And then in the last year of President Biden's administration, there was consensus around trying to fully fund the agencies that are handling immigration matters. But what we really need is significant legislative action on this issue, because we have a large segment of folks who are here who are good citizens. You know, they work hard, they raise kids, they pay taxes, and yet they really don't have a legal pathway to adjust their status.
Well, and I think another argument in their case would be the fact that we as taxpayers have paid to educate them, right? I mean, it's like this, it's kind of our investment. And why wouldn't we want to support that? But here locally, it's just, I guess you feel like your hands are tied, right? I mean, you just can't do anything about it.
I think, you know, us locally and at Wasatch Immigration Project, we have made a decision not to focus on policy, but to focus on people. And, you know, we, of course, partner with organizations that try to impact policy. We do have organizations here in Utah, local parts of national organizations. The ACLU of Utah is very involved with trying to impact policy at the state and national level. The Utah Immigrant Advocacy Coalition is very invested in trying to impact local legislation. So during the state legislature's term, they always are active up there to try to impact laws that can impact smaller parts of the lives of folks who are navigating the immigration process, like driver privilege cards and the ability to send money home to family members that might be having a really hard time.
Yeah. Walk us through what happens when someone comes to you for help.
Of course. Well, if you or someone you know needs immigration, legal advice, or representation, you can request a consult by calling WIP. Or filling out our contact form on wasatchimmigrationproject.org. Once we receive a request, someone on our team reaches out to you to complete an intake questionnaire. That will help us know what kind of services you are seeking. If we provide those services, you will be added to our wait list for an appointment with an attorney. If we don't provide those services, we will then provide you with a list of trusted resources. And that is one of the resources we do provide to the community here. We don't do everything. We can't do everything. And so we do try our best to reach out into the community and see who is providing the services that we don't, and make sure that they are trusted resources. There are some bad actors in this space, and as you might imagine, a lot of our clients are very vulnerable because they're concerned about their immigration status. They are trying really hard to fly under the radar, and there are people that will take advantage of that. So we try to vet that.
Unfortunately, what does that your wait list look like?
You know, at the end of 2024, we had a wait list of about 150. At the end of last year, due to some strategic hiring, with the benefit, you know, we with the benefit of the grant from the Women's Giving Fund, as well as other grants that we received, we were able to staff up, really build our legal team. We hired two attorneys that had just graduated from the University of Utah. They passed the bar last summer and joined us in the late summer. We hired two bilingual paralegals who are amazing. And so that brought our staff up to six people. And that group really allowed us to not only take on more clients, but take them on more, adopt the policies and procedures to not only take them on more quickly, but also to do it more effectively. And so that wait list whittled down to 25 at the end of last year. I think, I don't do math in public, but I'm pretty sure that it was right around 80% reduction in our wait list last year. Unfortunately, with the recent detentions, that wait list has crept up. We're hovering, I believe, right around 40 right now. And I anticipate it'll probably stay around there. We are engaging with not only local attorneys who do some work for us on a contract basis, but we held a training last week that was really exciting down in the Valley. We've been partnering with other practitioners in the state to try to build the volunteer attorney core that are available and trained to handle these types of cases. And we actually participated and organized a training for about 40 attorneys who have agreed in exchange for that training to take on at least one bond proceeding on a pro bono basis or no cost basis. And so we're trying to leverage what we've learned. We're trying to leverage the current interest and current concern in not just the community at large, but the legal community specifically, to try to build a volunteer corps. Those folks will take on cases on their own, but with mentorship from Wasatch Immigration Project.
Hmm. And as you mentioned, you did receive that $90,000 grant from the Women's Giving Fund. So that's what you've used and to hire, sounds like, two full-time attorneys and then some paralegals?
You know, we have used that money. As you know, the Women's Giving Fund is just tremendously supportive. We decided to use that money and budget it over 3 years. And so it is making a dent in our current budget. But we also have we've just experienced such tremendous support from the community at large. We have significant grants, not only from the Women's Giving Fund, but also from the Promontory Foundation, the Utah Bar Foundation, which has been tremendously supportive, the Marriott Daughters Foundation and others. And we have some individuals that have come on to really try to help us staff up in this time when we really needed to grow our team and grow it quickly.
Hmm. I also wanted, before I let you go, on Tuesday, the Women's Giving Fund had brought in the author, Stephanie Canzales. It sounds like you got a good turnout for that, huh?
We did. Stephanie is just an amazing person. Her work is very impactful, if not a little dense. I'm not a sociologist, so it was challenging for me to read. But she makes her work so accessible. And we had about 50 people attend, not only to hear her talk, but to hear. We then had a community conversation around placemaking for those folks who were really are struggling to find places in the community where they belong.
Okay. So. Anything else you wanted to mention, Maggie?
Yeah, you know, I appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk to more than one person at a time right now. We're getting a lot of calls in light of what's been happening the last 2 weeks. People are feeling really unsettled. And so being able to talk to more than one person at a time is really helpful about the work we're doing, what we're seeing. What can people do? I'm hearing that a lot. And what I would recommend is, first, if you have friends who are at risk, ask them what they need. They may need a carpool for their kids. They may need groceries. Please let them direct you to what their needs might be. If you don't have anyone in particular, or if you want to do more, volunteer for nonprofits like WIP, who are helping immigrants and their families. March, call your representatives, vote. All of these things make an impact. And I have one other thing that I wanted to mention, and this is breaking news, but we have just gotten approval from the city to hold a walk with WIP. It's going to be on June 13th, and we are going to be starting at the top of Main Street, and we're going to be walking to Library Field. Registration will be limited to 100 people, so we encourage folks to register early and come walk with us. Show your support for all of the community. There will be breakfast and community partners to welcome us at the finish.
Okay, Maggie, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
Maggie Abu-Hadar, again, is the Executive Director and co-founder of the Wasatch Immigration Project. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Summit County has selected the novel Go as a River as this year's One Book, One Community Read. In the studio with details, I have Summit County Library Director Dan Compton. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
So for listeners who may not be familiar, what is the One Book, One Community program?
Thanks, Leslie. So yes, we've been running this program for quite a while now, and we try to run this every summer. We partner with the Park City Library, and the goal of this program is to provide a shared experience of reading for Summit County, and just to get everybody, reading the same book and having meaningful conversations about it. So it's something I always look forward to.
Okay, and so why was this book, Go as a River by Shelley Reed, selected?
We try to find books that will resonate with our local community. So a lot of them take place in the American West and have themes that we feel people will relate to. And this one we feel really strongly about. It takes place in rural Colorado, and it's back in the 1940s through about the 1970s in a town called Iola. And this town was eventually submerged under the Blue Mesa Reservoir because they dammed the Gunnison River. And so the residents in Iola were displaced. And that right away resonated with us because we have Rockport and Jordan L reservoirs where those small towns experience similar fates. And so that immediately appealed to us. But then also this is just a really powerful coming of age story. The main character has experienced some tragedy in her life, and she's only 17 years old and is helping run her family's peach farm. And there's just a lot of interesting themes in the novel we think are going to resonate with people, and also that local history tie-in. So that's why we selected this one this year.
Yeah, and who does select the book each year?
So there's a committee that consists of librarians from Summit County Library and Park City Library. And this year we were also able to get a representative from the Friends of Park City Library and a representative from Friends of the Summit County Library, along with a representative from Dolly's Bookstore. So it was a really good committee this year, and we hope to keep that moving forward.
Yeah. Did you have several books come and then have to decide amongst them?
Yeah, everybody kind of brings some options to the table, and we try to read as many as we can. And then, of course, a big factor is, can we get this author to actually come to town with the budget that we have? And so we feel very fortunate that we're able to get the author, Shelley Reed, to come. This is her debut novel, but it's been very successful. It's won a lot of awards. It's been optioned for film. Like, we're excited to get her here before she gets even more successful.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. What sort of events and discussions are planned around the book this year?
So, of course, Shelley Reed will be visiting in late July. So her visit will be on Thursday, July 30th at 7 p.m. That will be in the Jim Santee Auditorium at Park City Library. And so she will speak to the community. And then following that, there will be a book signing with Dolly's there providing books for purchase. And then we've got two other supporting programs planned so far. Number one will be on Thursday, June 18th at 6:30 p.m. at the Old Church at Rockport State Park. So we're going to have Alan Sitaway come and speak about his family's experience in Rockport before they were displaced. And it'll be at that historic church building. So we think that's going to be a really special event with that local history tie-in. And then also there will be a community book discussion planned at the Park City Library that will be facilitated by Dolly's Bookstore. That's planned for Thursday, July 9th, beginning at 4 p.m. after the book discussion, we're working with Taggy's Famous Fruits to actually come and talk a little bit about their history and also do a little taste testing of some peaches and things like that afterwards. So those, we're really looking forward to these supporting events and the author's visit this year.
Okay. Let's see. Have you noticed how the participation in the one book read has grown over the years? Do you have any way to
definitely
touch that?
Yeah, we kind of have developed this system now where we're starting to announce the book in May, have some supporting events in June and July leading up to the author's visit. And it's really neat to see how a lot of our local book groups have taken to this, and they will choose this book as one of their selections for the summer. We have like the Newcomers Book Club that takes it, some of our library book clubs and others as well. And the great thing about this, we always try to find books that we can make readily available through our digital lending platform, Libby. So anyone with a Summit County Library card or Park City Library card can go on Libby now and get this ebook or audiobook with no wait time. And so making it readily available, it's just accessible. Anyone can get it, read it this summer, and let's have some really good conversations about it.
How long does that opportunity last until the author's visit?
So the book will be available through the end of July.
Okay. And then you also have several copies at the libraries?
Physical copies, plenty at both libraries. And of course, you can also go to Dolly's Bookstore and they'll have plenty of copies if you'd like to just purchase one, and then you can have it signed later.
Okay. Hey, let's talk a little bit while we have a few minutes left. What's the latest with the library move?
Yeah, so construction is happening at the new Peak Center, formerly the Skull Candy Building. And I've been able to go over a couple times and they're making good progress. We are just prepping a lot through the shelving plans and the furniture plans and things like that, and mapping out where we're going to be moving all the collection over and getting prepared for this big move. I wish I knew exactly when it was going to happen. I'm told mid-July is like what they're looking at as a completion date. I'm just telling people late summer because I know there could be more delays and things like that. So it's hard for us to get an exact time, but we're doing everything we can as a staff to now start preparing and getting ready for that move. Luckily, we're not having to move the shelving over. We're getting new shelving, so that will be so much easier for us. But still, it's moving 50,000 books, and that is quite the undertaking. But we're ready and excited and really excited for this new space. It is larger than what we currently have. I would say just in the library proper, at least 2,500 more square feet. And then if you count like the lobby space, the shared auditorium and conference rooms and things like that, it is significantly more space. Ultimately, that Peak Center is like two Richens buildings. And that first floor, if you count all the shared space we have, it's almost like more than the entire Richens building right now. So it's not all library. We have DMV in there. And of course, you know, the council will be in their space, but we can use that shared auditorium space like we do now to show films and have larger events. So we're really excited. And then in the library itself, just having some more study rooms and conference rooms available to the public, that's something that people have always wanted. Beautiful views looking out at the Olympic Park. Like, we just couldn't ask for a better opportunity here.
Yeah. When you say 50,000 books, I mean, how much bigger could you, how many more books could you roll by? Any idea?
So I will say, like, I think our children's area is going to be able to expand the collection wise, but I think the adult and the teen are not going to be a huge expansion there. But also, it's not really as necessary because of the digital collections now and how many people have kind of started moving to using Libby more. We still think that physical collection is extremely important, especially for kids and everybody, but it's not going to be, that's not the main focus, is just getting more space for books. It's more having that community space and places for people to touch down and have a quiet space to work and study.
Okay. So late summer, early fall then.
Yeah, that's what we're saying.
Okay. Are you going to have any kind of book raid, or are you just going to hire movers to move all the books?
So we are going to we're not going to do a book brigade to move the entire collection, but we would like to have an event as part of kind of closing one chapter, beginning a new chapter. And we will be moving a symbolic kind of book brigade and moving it across the street. It'll be the last book that moves over, ending that chapter at the Richens Building and beginning a new one.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention, Dan?
No, just thanks for the opportunity. And yeah, we encourage everybody to participate in One Book, One Community. We're looking forward to it.
Okay, me too. All right, Dan Compton again serves as Summit County Library Director. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.